Tuesday, June 10th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. Hello.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Tuesday, June 10th, New Jersey primary day. Get to the polls, folks, if you haven't already. Of course, if you're a resident of New Jersey, please.
Yeah.
Not encouraging any Pennsylvania residents to go vote in New Jersey today.
No, we'll just look over the bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
And just see,
binoculars.
Yeah, yeah, see what's happening over there in Jersey. Big gubernatorial race there, top of the ticket there today. So today's show is all about college athletes getting paid. A federal judge on Friday approved a $2.8 billion settlement that will allow colleges to pay student athletes directly for the very first time in NCAA history. And it marks a momentous shift from the NCAA's long-held amateurism model, effectively professionalizing college sports. So today we're going to talk about who will benefit, who will get left behind. How will this impact colleges? How will this impact academics, right? How will this impact professional leagues, the Olympics? So many questions. And our question for you today is this. Do you think paying college athletes will ruin what made college sports so special? Or will it fix a system that was always unfair? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the chat.
Speaking as a retired NCAA athlete myself,
Mr. Baseball, I really feel man himself.
I really feel like I was cheated out of millions, you know. But it is funny because, you know, I was like a very bad Division III baseball player.
I don't believe that.
Oh, no, I was bad. Trust me. Okay. We have witnesses on that. But so I was at like the bottom rung of the bottom rung. Mm. But I was part of the same organization that was overseeing, like, at that time, like Kevin Durant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And presumably we got some of the same trainings about what the NCAA rules were. You couldn't bet. You couldn't whatever. Certain things you couldn't accept, right? And it does make you realize what a large and in many ways unwieldy organization it is.
It is.
That they would be overseeing me and like some of the best athletes on the planet, mm-hmm, and trying to govern them according to some of the same rules. And so this has always been a very difficult thing to manage. And now it's moving in at warp speed into this new era. I mean, there's a lot to talk about here.
Yeah, so many questions, so much impact, because the ripple effect, I mean, we can't even tell what it's going to be.
It's rippling.
Yeah, it's rippling already. It just happened on Friday, but it's been rippling for a while. So.
Yeah, a lot of rippling. Let's start with some local news stories, a trio perhaps. And the first story we're going to talk about today is some big business news in Pennsylvania. Tech giant Amazon announced yesterday it would spend $20 billion in PA to boost its AI infrastructure. This includes building big data centers, those big energy-hungry data centers. We know at least two of the locations of these new Amazon data centers. One is going to be in Northeast PA, and one's going to be in Falls Township, Bucks County, which is kind of near like the Trenton, mm-hmm, area. So the Northeast Pennsylvania facility is going to draw power from a nearby nuclear plant, and that has drawn some federal scrutiny, some questions about that. Mm-hmm. The one in Bucks County is on the site of a U.S. steel facility, and that's in, like I said before, the Falls Township area. So some big news, and it's going to impact us locally for sure.
Yeah, pretty big deal. I mean, it's bringing 1,200 jobs to Pennsylvania, thousands of more jobs in construction jobs. Not bad. And what interested me about this is that the Commonwealth is also given some incentives,
yep,
in the billions of dollars. They're also going to put up millions to train people at local community colleges and other facilities to make sure that Pennsylvania has the workforce that can man these facilities.
Another interesting note that I'll add, a little, mm-hmm, bit of a history aside, is that the Bucks County location where they're going to build this data center I mentioned, it used to be owned by U.S. Steel, and it was a plant that was opened in 1952. At its peak employment in the 70s, 9,000 people worked at that U.S. Steel plant. It closed in 2001, but remember that number, 9,000.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that this whole investment is going to produce, what, 1,200 jobs?
Yeah, and I double-checked. It was not 12,000, it's 1,200.
And
yeah,
it's like a parable for our times, and it shows how, mm-hmm, how everything has changed. The year that they opened that U.S. steel facility in Bucks County in 1952, they also broke ground right around that same time on Levittown, one of the first mm-hmm. big prefab suburbs, and another community called Fairless Hills,
yeah.
which was connected to that plant. That plant, those workers, filled those new suburban communities.
Wow.
And so you think about that steel plant that kind of helped build like a middle-class suburb in Bucks County being replaced by a data center that's going to employ far fewer people. And it just shows you how everything has changed.
It has changed so much. It'll be interesting, though. And I'm glad that those investments are coming locally. They've also opened all those big warehouse centers as well in Delaware and in New Jersey. By the way, moving on to our next story, California Governor Gavin Newsom is in a heated battle with the Trump administration over ICE protests in Los Angeles. And to make a point, Newsom threw Eagles fans under the bus in a post on X. How did we get in this, right? That's the question. And on Sunday, I'll explain the saga. On Sunday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted a photo of some L.A. protesters burning what appeared to be a car in that city, saying another mostly peaceful protest brought to you by Gavin Newsom. And in response, the governor's official account said, are you going to send in the Marines the next time the Philadelphia Eagles win too? And that attached photo is of people wearing Eagles gear standing near a burning car, appearing to be celebrating what else but an Eagles win. I couldn't tell if it was a Super Bowl or what.
Then yeah, we've seen that photo.
Yeah. Yeah. But then to add fuel to the fire, or shall I say rolling the bus over Philadelphia fans, okay? Apparently, the governor's comms director told Fox News Digital, he says, L.A., have you ever seen what happens when the Eagles win a playoff game? Shots fired, California. The Inquirer, got no comment from the California governor's office or the Philadelphia Eagles on this. But, you know, California has sued the Trump administration over a pretty serious thing, over its deployment of thousands of California National Guard troops, as well as 700 Marines that have been sent to Los Angeles in response to protests against the ICE raids that have been going on in that city. And, you know, there's this battle going on. And you know, California officials say, look, the Trump administration has overstepped. Deploying these troops right now is unconstitutional. But the president and his administration says, look, you know, the situation in L.A. is dire. We need to protect federal property and federal officials.
I mean, look, I just say as a Philadelphia reporter, the craziest stuff I've ever seen or covered has been at Philadelphia Eagles celebrations. Now, mm-hmm. that's just my personal, like what I've been at.
Yeah.
Like I've covered plenty of protests and usually it's a pretty humdrum affair. When the Eagles win, it's sort of like anything goes.
Yeah. And they sent National Guard troops.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that they're totally analogous situations. It's just, but it is like when you actually think about large crowds and like a sense of feeling like it's not quite in control,
mm-hmm.
like those Eagles things, it's just sort of like anything goes. I've seen some wild stuff at those post Eagles wins.
I have too. Yeah. I think most reporters, if you've been here in the past few years when we won big from 08, I think when we won the World Series.
Oh yeah.
I was like, it was crazy. That was my introduction to Philadelphia teams winning. I had just moved here. I was
in
like,
08?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a very hairy situation in 08. I was not a reporter yet, but that mm-hmm. story for another time. Anyways, yeah. Final story on our local news roundup today. Wilmington, Delaware wants to boost its nightlife, Cherry.
Ooh.
And to do so, the city is formally asking the state to allow bars to stay open until 2 a.m. Now, they need state approval because Delaware is the only state in the Mid-Atlantic region that cuts off alcohol service before 2 a.m., according to Delaware Online. Which leads to the question, Cherry, how late should bars and restaurants be open or allowed to be open?
I think 2 a.m. is a good time. And I get it. I mean, I lived in Wilmington. And I mean, how can you compete when Philly has a $26 billion nighttime economy and you closing at 1 a.m. Womp womp.
So you think 2 a.m. just to put a bow on it? You think 2 a.m.?
Maybe even 3, you know? But I definitely feel like 2 a.m. should be a standard time across the region. You shouldn't be the only one closing earlier.
Why are there laws around when restaurants have to close? Like, honestly, I don't know.
I'm thinking maybe public safety issues, the number of police available or something like that. That's the only thing that comes to mind, but I have no sourcing for that.
Like New York City, they're open
24/7. Yeah, but they have a larger police force, more people, you know.
I don't know. I have to be convinced on this.
You felt like 1 a.m. is okay? Maybe like only two extra people would come through?
No, I'm saying just keep them open all night.
Oh, 24. Oh, you're a 24-hour guy? I didn't know.
Live and let live. I don't know. I have to be convinced. It's a weird standard I've always lived with, and I just don't know the explanation for it. Anyways, okay. Speaking of making money, college athletes are going to be able to do that. They already can, but even more so in the future. We're going to talk about it coming up on Studio 2.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. FYI, according to our producers in New York State, you can serve liquor until 4 a.m.
Oh.
Can't even do it all night in New York.
No.
I understand, I guess, cutting off the liquor at some point. Mm-hmm. But I think at least let the establishment stay open if people want to congregate, hang out. We've got a loneliness epidemic, Cherry.
You know, you need those bars.
You need those bars.
At least for the stool. Yes.
Okay, so getting back to the main topic. Cherry, question for you. What do you think was the first intercollegiate sporting event?
I don't know.
Maybe a big football game, like a track meet, maybe. Baseball's really old. None of the above. It was a rowing race held in 1852, Harvard versus Yale.
Of course, I knew you would find that. Avi Wolfman Arendt in those crates. Well, we've come a long way from Ivy League regattas. College sports rakes in billions, and now players are getting a cut. A landmark settlement approved Friday allows schools to directly pay student athletes for the very first time.
I'm in the crates. Can you explain that real quick?
Yeah.
How am I in the crates?
The news crates.
Oh, yeah.
Like nice. Old newspaper.
Oh, I like that. Thank you. Anyways, the settlement. The settlement does not leave college sports settled. Far from it. There are big questions now about who will get paid, who will get left behind, and whether the balance of power has tilted even further in the direction of big schools like Penn State and away from smaller schools like Villanova and St. Joe's.
And to help us explain how we got here and where all of this might be going, we've enlisted the help of Lane Higgins, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Lane, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And our question for you, our listeners, is this. Do you think paying college athletes will ruin what made college sports so special? Or is it a fix that will Or will it fix a system, that was always unfair? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comments in the chat.
Maybe let's start with a caller here.
Yeah.
We've got Ellen from Cape May on the line. Ellen, you are setting us up this hour. I think you have a take on our big question about whether paying college athletes will ruin it or fix a system that was always unfair. So, Ellen, you're on Studio 2, kicking us off this hour.
Well, thank you. I don't know that I can say it will fix things, but what I can say is that major media, the colleges, the coaches make billions and millions of dollars a year off the backs of these students, and it's about time they got paid. It's the only big business I know where the actual workers don't make any money.
A lot of people feel that way. Great call from Ellen and Cape May. So, Lane, let's use that as a springboard. For decades and decades and decades, we were told that college sports must be kept amateur. And then all of a sudden, these lawsuits popped up challenging that system, and they were successful, which is odd because, as far as I know, like the Constitution didn't really change. I don't think a lot of laws changed, but all of a sudden there were these successful lawsuits. So what actually changed that created the cracks in the amateurism dam that the NCAA had been sort of had erected for so many generations?
Yeah, so the biggest crack that appeared happened actually in the 80s. There was a Supreme Court case because, you know, in the middle of the last century, if you wanted to watch college football, there was only one entity that was in control of broadcasting that, and that was the NCAA. And actually, one of the teams that had most of their games broadcast was the University of Pennsylvania when they were playing at Franklin Field. And, you know, funnily enough, you know, there were some schools that were really not excited about this because it made it hard for them to reach potential fans. And there was a lot of money that was, in theory, being left on the table. So it's the Board of Regents of the University of Oklahoma and the University of Georgia sue the NCAA. It works its way all the way up. And the Supreme Court basically says that it's anti-competitive for the NCAA to be limiting who can be broadcasting. And it wrested football away control-wise from the NCAA, such that the NCAA no longer operates the college football playoff, which is, you know, where we crown our national champion. And the top level of college football, so not Villanova, not St. Joe's, and not those schools, but Penn State, those operate under a completely different umbrella. And basically, by separating the TV rights control and allowing conferences to strike deals with networks to broadcast their own TV, it opened the door for this floodgate of money. And, you know, that's why we see the Big Ten signing, you know, an over $1 billion deal. And that's why you see millions and millions of dollars flooding into these athletic departments. And as that starts to happen, you start to realize, wait, so why are we putting arbitrary limits on this? And it's this slow erosion of pieces where you're attacking one piece of the foundation, then the next, and over time, as attitudes have changed and people realize, wait, maybe this isn't the most fair, because one, to the point of the caller, you know, this is an industry that's pretty dependent on free labor. And everyone else, because of the influx of money from TV, is able to make millions and millions of dollars. That the optics of that increasingly look bad. And then you also have this dynamic where there's always kind of been bagmen who are giving money to athletes under the table. And you have, you know, some famous scandals with that, like SMU with the death penalty, and, you know, Eric Dickerson famously getting his gold Trans Am car, actually from a booster of a school that he didn't even go to. But, you know, you have all of these things where people are like, well, maybe it's not so bad. And it starts with getting additional scholarships and cost of attendance covered. And then there's some educational benefits, which was Alston. And then it builds and builds and builds. And then it's endorsement deals that you can get, which is the world that we've currently been living in up until last week. And now for the first time, it's going to be revenue sharing. So athletes are basically, it's not a salary, but it's kind of moving that way.
And so let's explain this, because a lot of people, a lot of states had passed the NIL laws a few years ago. And then now we have this landmark settlement. And so let's explain, how is this different from NIL, and what will it entail when it comes to paying these student athletes?
Yeah, so there are two main pieces of this settlement. There's a backward-looking piece, which actually does deal with NIL, and it's for athletes who were in college from about 2016 onward and some lost NIL earnings that they potentially had. And that is, you know, I think like $1.6 billion-ish of back pay that's going to these athletes. And then there's also a forward-looking piece that is about how athletes are going to be treated going forward. And what that is that basically you look at the average revenue of all of the schools in the top tier of Division I athletics. And, you know, that goes from a Texas or an Alabama or Ohio State, where they're bringing in $250 million for their athletic department, or a smaller school that's bringing in $20 million. So you take that average, divide it by half, and then you subtract the amount of scholarships and grant and aid and other, you know, cost of attendance benefits that these athletes are getting. And the balance is how much these schools now have to pay athletes. So the thinking is that it's similar to how professional leagues do it with the 50-50 revenue sharing. But, you know, included in the athlete's cut is the scholarship. So it's not that they're just getting 50% of the average revenue. And obviously this is a financial burden that's going to be a lot bigger for some schools, because that money works out to about $22.5 million for everyone in the athletic department for the next calendar year. It will adjust as time goes on. And, you know, for a school like Texas that has $250 million in its budget, it's a little bit easier to find $20 million to reallocate, versus if that's your whole budget, there's no way you can afford to spend to that cap. Now, obviously, that's a maximum. You don't have to do it. You don't have to opt in.
You can spend up to that much. Some schools will. Some schools assuredly will not. So can you give us a sense of, like, how many schools out there could reasonably spend that much on what are essentially player salaries? And within that answer, when you're, you know, not just how many schools, but of the schools that do spend that much, who are they going to spend it on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And one that I think a lot of the schools have spent the last year trying to, you know, do some creative accounting to figure this out, because the thinking is, if you want to be competitive, you have to spend the maximum, mm-hmm. because everything in college football is an arms race, you would think. And, you know, not just college football, all college sports with recruiting. And, you know, the thinking is that most of the schools in the four major conferences, so the Big Ten, the Big 12, the ACC, and the Southeastern Conference, they will spend the maximum. Mm. I know for a fact that not every school, it's about 60 or so in that group, can afford to do that. So they might get close. They might get to 18 million or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're going to try their hardest. And it's schools that are in the lower tier of conferences, like the Mid-American Conference or the Mountain West, that they want to try to spend that much to be competitive, but it's just not realistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's going to be a pretty stark dividing line. Like, there's already haves and have nots in college sports. And I think we're just starting to, this is going to cause some further separation.
And
of
just for some local context on this, like, talk about your local schools here. Temple is not in one of those big conferences mm-hmm. that Lane just talked about, nor is actually Villanova. They're in a big basketball conference, but not for football. St. Joe's, LaSalle, Drexel, forget about it. And Penn is in a totally different world. So when we look at the local impact here,
Yeah, Penn didn't even opt into the settlement. Yeah.
And what does that
they're
mean?
They're not paying athletes.
Yeah, that means that they're just not going to pay. When you opt out, that's what it means.
Yeah, and the Ivy League as a whole conference opted out of that. Yeah. And they, I mean, they treat athletics a little bit differently anyway, and that they don't do athletic scholarships the same way that most other universities do. So they're kind of an asterisk there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's lots of other schools like the University of Maine that decided to opt out because they're like, look, we can't afford this.
And sorry, and just the follow-up question of, okay, so you get this big chunk of money, assuming you have the wherewithal to spend it. Who do you spend it on? And I think the answer is basically football and basketball, maybe.
Yeah.
Some women's basketball, a little bit.
So how this works is, as part of the settlement, they hired an economist to look at, you know, who's generating the most revenue. And, you know, that's a problem. And saying basically, if you bring in the money, then you deserve to get a share of the money, which, you know, makes some common sense. And the upshot of that is about 70-75% of the money is, I mean, a lot of athletic departments, football is making more than that, but teams are planning to spend roughly 70-70%, or schools are planning to spend that much on the football team.
Wow.
About 15% will be to men's basketball, another 5% or so to women's basketball, and 5% for every other sport.
Yeah.
5% for every other sport. I mean, think about it. That's most of the athletes.
Yeah.
But get this, a lot of schools, you know, the NCAA minimum for Division One in a lot of these conferences is sponsoring 16 sports. So you take away, you know, the three mm-hmm. that are definitely getting revenue. Then you have 13 sports sharing 5%. Well, a lot of schools are like, well, that's just silly if we are giving everyone like $10,000. So they've decided, like Penn State, they probably will pay their wrestling team.
Mm.
They, you know, some of their bigger programs, maybe women's volleyball. I don't know. But then
if you have a legacy of success in that sport, you might throw a little change at it to maintain your status as the best volleyball team.
And by the way, I want to bring in a caller. We have Katie, who is in a Wawa parking lot right now in New Jersey, listening to the show. So we got to bring Katie on the show. She was a D1 athlete at Villanova. So, Katie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to say, as a product of Title IX, I felt blessed and lucky that my school was paid for. I didn't have to pay to go to college. Whereas a lot of people, I don't know that anybody really takes that into consideration anymore, that you're winning because you're getting to go to school for free.
Yeah.
And one of the best schools in the country, I went to Villanova.
Yeah.
And then, so what my concern is with this whole athletes getting paid is that it is going to ruin. I understand that NCAA is corrupt as all get out, but I feel like this is going to ruin college sports. You play because you love it.
Mm. Yeah.
And that is just my take on the situation, and it's unfortunate. I realize that basketball, football, they bring in all the money. But it's just, I don't know, it's just a sad thing.
And I want to put, and Katie, you played, field hockey. And you told our producers you believe field hockey would disappear. Why do you think that?
I think that a lot of girls' sports will disappear because we don't bring in the money.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, if we had five fans, it was a lot.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and most of the fans we had were our parents. So it's a different perspective, and you have to look at it that way as well. My sister was a D1 athlete at Hofstra. She played basketball. And you just don't want the girls' sports to go away. Mm.
Thank you. That's Katie calling us from a Wawa parking lot in New Jersey. And this was a big topic. Avi and I both wanted to talk about this, you know, because Title IX, requires gender equity in sports. And I want to talk about the impact that this payment scheme will have on that. The only real women's sports that I saw included in this calculation was women's basketball with a small percentage and then 5% to every other. How will this impact women's sports?
So that's a great question. And as part of the settlement, so this is going to sound like I'm taking a detour, but I promise it's related. But as part of the settlement, the NCAA basically said, we no longer have to cap scholarships. So you can give a scholarship to every single person that's on your team. So as it currently stands, like in football, for instance, there are 85 scholarships and most rosters have like 110, 120 players. So that means that there's a fair amount of walk-ons. And in a sport like softball, there would be 13 scholarships for a team of 25 to 30. And, you know, that means that some people are on full ride, some people are getting partial. But basically, you know, you have room for players that are still paying their way to play their sport. And with the new rules, you can scholarship everyone, but there's now also rostered limits. So for softball, if you had 30 people on your team, you now have to cut 5 because the limit is going to be 25. So you can have everyone get a scholarship, but you are somehow taking away opportunities. And that's not just for women's sports. That's for basically every single Olympic sport is going to be kind of dealing with this math equation. And it's interesting because you're increasing the aid. So yes, you might play field hockey and you might not have, you know, gotten a scholarship before. So you might be getting that aid. You probably won't be getting a cut from revenue sharing, but you have to be good enough to be within the roster limit. So, you know, for instance, I was a swimmer at Penn and we had 40 women on our team. The limit for swimming is now going to go down to something like 25.
Wow.
That means almost half of our team would lose their opportunity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, so there are a lot of strange ways where, in theory, the group that got the most scholarships as a result of the settlement is women, because they had to balance out all of the scholarships that are on the football team. But you are also losing opportunities in some ways.
So in a way, more scholarships maybe for women athletes, but fewer roster spots for women athletes, which means fewer women athletes
generally,
overall.
Yeah.
Yes. And also more costs for the university because they're having to fund these extra scholarships. And, you know, even if you're saving a little bit of money by not having as many players that you have to, you know, put in a hotel, you're still, you know, spending a lot of money, and it such that you're not bringing in a ton more, and it's becoming an increasingly financially difficult thing for a school to justify having a sport like that.
That's what I was going to ask about.
That's the follow-up question, because does this mean that certain sports could be eliminated or cut altogether?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a huge question. And kind of one that's existential because, you know, if you think about the Olympics, so many of Team USA and a lot of other countries' Olympians train in the United States collegiate system. You know, we're one of the only countries that doesn't have a ministry of sport, and it's have state-funded institutions with that. And like, yes, you know, we have, you know, USA Swimming, USA Track and Field, but by and large, most of the athletes are coming from the college system.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you take away opportunities for that, the theory is that it would hurt the performance of the United States and other countries on the international stage. Well, guess what we have coming up in 2028? A hometown Olympics.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles.
In which you want to be increasing your support. And so these are kind of these forces that are butting heads right now. And a lot of people think that schools will maybe hold on to these programs through 2028 because there's a really, you know, obvious reason to do it with the Olympics. And then maybe once that passes, they'll start cutting stuff and there'll be a huge reduction in opportunities.
One thing we still haven't really talked about is the fact that these are still schools. They're educational institutions. So let's bring in a caller now. This is Janet from Westtown, Chester County. By the way, Westtown School out there in Chester County has one of the best prep basketball programs in the country. Shout so a lot out. Of big time sports happening out in Westtown. But Janet's out in Westtown right now and wants to comment for the show today. Janet, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Well, I'm hearing the word scholarship, and I'm thinking, and I'm hearing the word university, and I'm thinking, what are these things about? Are they not about education? And why are we not talking about what the impact of this will be on athletes' interest in education? And as it is right now, without them being paid over and above the free tuition and room and board and so forth, they're already prioritizing their athletics over their schoolroom, over their school's education. Mm. And I've been a faculty member at Westchester University and gotten phone calls from coaches saying, "Hey, you think you could give my boy a C? You know, he's got all this other practicing he has to do, and so he can't really get to class all the time." I'm thinking, what's the point? Why do we have sports in universities if they're going to crowd out education?
That's a great point.
I'm just wondering, what is the impact going to be if we put more money into student athletes' pockets?
Thank you so much.
Will they be more?
Yeah, Janet, thank you so much. We want to make sure we have a chance to answer that question. And Matt has a very similar question. Mm-hmm. Matt says, it's time we take the college out of college sports. How about sports programs become separate nonprofits that affiliate with schools in the NCAA? They can professionalize at will, become the pipeline to pro sports they already are, without worrying about those pesky academics. What's the impact on these academic institutions, Lane Higgins?
Because they're working. This is a job now.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is it kind of goes both ways in that well before athletes were paid any money, being an athlete dramatically limited your academic options at a school. Yep. So if you were going to be pre-med, you know, good luck going to labs if you have a crazy travel schedule. And, you know, the minute these conferences stretch coast to coast and Penn State players had to go to UCLA, you know, you're missing class for that. It makes it harder to have certain majors. It makes it harder to have the same academic opportunities. You know, you miss office hours, you have to do makeup tests. Like, you know, there were plenty of times where I remember taking exams in like the breakfast foyer of a Holiday Inn because we were at a travelsome meet and that's all you could do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a very different experience doing that. And that's been that way for a long time. I think this would, you know, maybe change the priorities for the athletes, because if they have a chance to make money from their sport and, you know, that's what they want to do professionally, it does sort of behoove them to put their eggs in that basket when they're an undergraduate. But at the same time, the interesting thing is we've started to see this a lot in sports like basketball, where there are really, really few opportunities for athletes in the pros. And that's, you know, people that maybe would have left early and entered the draft as, you know, before they got their degree are now testing the waters there, but then coming back and staying, and sometimes even getting master's degrees or, you know, going to grad school because they can make money in college, and often
there's
way
an
more
incentive
money in
to stay in school.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not true for every sport, because, you know, there's not really a pro swimming opportunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, field hockey might be tough, but, you know, baseball, softball, even basketball, football, like, you're starting to see athletes kind of stick around instead of trying to be on the fringes of the professional world. There are some benefits, but I have to think that the pressures that are already on academics are only going to increase.
Yeah. Lisa emails, the system was never fair to the athletes who bring the fans and revenue to the school, pay them, period. On the other side of this, though, I want to talk about holdouts, some of the professional tactics that are used in professional leagues being used in college sports already, and how it could change college sports altogether. Hopefully you'll call in 888-477-9499. Do you think paying college athletes will ruin what made college sports special? We'll talk about this on the other side of the break.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I am your local crate master, Avi Wolfman Arendt.
you wear that title
very well. What a jacket, a bomber jacket.
And I'm Cherry Gregg, and we've been talking about the recent $2.8 billion court settlement that has opened the door to colleges sharing some of their sports revenue with college athletes or student athletes and the resulting impact on college sports generally.
And now let me reintroduce our guest for the hour. Lane Higgins is a sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And our question for you this hour, do you think paying college athletes will ruin what made college sports special or fix a system that was always unfair? Here's an email from Rob. How is it a core mission of higher education to field semi-pro teams? Get rid of them. College sports teams should be recruited from students who have already been accepted on the basis of academics. I understand the sentiment. I do think the ship has sailed, Rob, but yes, we can still talk about it. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment right there in the chat.
And so I want to talk about the impact of more money. And I want to talk about the Tennessee quarterback who staged a contract holdout and lost. Can you? And I want you to explain the story because you wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal. Lay it all out for us, and will we see more of this?
It's a great question about whether we'll see more, but to backtrack, so Nico Yamaleva was one of the best quarterback recruits out of California, and when he was coming out of high school, he signed a deal with the University of Tennessee that at the time was set the high water mark. It was, I think, $8 million over the course of his career, you know, pending some incentives, and, you know, you have to achieve some things if you're going to get the full amount, but still, that's a lot of money. And he played last year. He started as a sophomore, and as he was going to be the presumable starter for this year. And as we get into spring football, there starts to be some chatter because, you know, he's happy at Tennessee. He's getting paid a lot, but there are other players who have since gone into the transfer portal and gotten paid even more. So like Carson Beck, who was the quarterback at Georgia, he got paid somewhere about $4 million for a single season to play at the University of Miami this upcoming season.
And so this Tennessee quarterback's looking at that and saying, I'd like a piece of that pie.
I can get more.
Yes. Saying, wait a second, I'm better than this guy. How come? And just because I signed a long-term deal, that doesn't reflect what this my value is. I should be getting more. And the university basically said, no, I think we're good. Like, I think we can pay. I think your amount of money is adequate. And, you know, so Nico tries to hold out. He doesn't go to spring practice. He doesn't go to the spring game. And then the coach effectively announces, yeah, he's off the team. Bye.
Wow.
And, you know, now Nico he transferred to UCLA.
Making
it's
less
unclear
money.
What he's making.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's certainly not $2 million mm-hmm. for this next year. So he lost out on money. And the university basically sent a message of like, look, we're in control of this. Like, you know, we're the boss. We can get someone better than you.
And
you're not worth that much.
This was so fascinating to me because this sounds like what you see NFL players do.
Oh, yeah.
Not college players. Do you anticipate more of this type of gamesmanship and negotiation tactics? Because these guys have agents, some of them. I mean, this is very professional level.
They all have agents.
Yeah. And what's funny is in talking to people in the wake of Nico's departure, they said that the only reason you're hearing about this is because it didn't work. Because there are so many times when these agents go to the schools and say, hey, we want a raise. And the school is kind of between a rock and a hard place and they have to say yes. Though a lot of the times this does work. And, you know, you're just not, maybe the demand isn't as extreme because you're not the quarterback that's already at the high end of the market.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe this gives some people pause about whether or not they want to do it. But I don't think this is going to stop it by any means because, you know, that aspect of this, agents just freewheeling, like that's still going to be pretty unprotected.
Mm. Let's bring in another caller now, another former college athlete on the line here. This is Jim from Lansdowne, who apparently went to Bucknell, go Bison, I think, in 1968 and was a D1 soccer player. Jim, what's your perspective as a former college athlete yourself?
I played for the love of the sport. That was it. I listened to the field hockey player who mentioned that. I agree so much with the callers that have been talking about it's education. Make up a team out of the people who are already accepted. The coaches have input on who gets accepted. So make up a team and do as well as you can. Playing soccer at Bucknell was wonderful, just wonderful. And we were a pretty good team, and we were a great bunch of teammates.
Yeah. And that's what you took away, I think, from that experience. That's Jim in Lansdowne.
Yeah.
Echoing how a lot of people feel. Mm-hmm. And I'll just flip the lens on this a little bit and say, if what we are drifting toward, Lane Higgins, is basically a version of pro sports where, frankly, the athletes are just not as good, what's in it for me as a viewer? Like,
or the games are not as good because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's just be honest. Like, the NBA is better than
college never has been.
Right. The NBA games are better. But there was something about college, I guess people maybe were drawn by that idea of people were in it for the love of the game and it was more pure or whatever than the NBA, NFL. That's not going to be part of the appeal, I would imagine, at all moving forward, if it was at all, to this point.
Mm-mm. And it's interesting because there's an element of tribalism and sort of an identification with a college in a way that there's not with professional teams. I think because not everyone goes to a college, right? But that's a far more universal experience than playing for a pro team. So you can legitimately claim, like, yes, this is my alma mater. I have a concrete stake and tie to this. So that's not going to go away because as long as these teams are still affiliated with universities, you're still going to have a fandom. And I think the interesting thing is, you know, the love of the game, yeah, that's probably still there for a lot of these athletes. They love it and they're also getting paid. And, you know, as recruiting has become more national, maybe there's less of a sense of, oh, I'm rooting for my hometown kid, or, you know, I grew up with this family and their boy is playing football for Penn State, so therefore I'm a Penn State fan.
Yeah.
Some of that's still going to happen, maybe to a lesser degree. But the thing that we've started to see a little bit in the last few years with NIL as, you know, this emergent payment system for athletes, there's actually been a lot more parity. I mean, if you look around at the upcoming football season, what team stands out as an absolutely dominant one that you know is going to probably win the title? Mm.
So you know, it's interesting, though,
and it could change.
It's almost like there's a new parity among a group of teams at the top. But my sense of what's changed, and this is really prevalent, like in the NCAA men's tournament, is that if you're not in that top group, you've almost got no shot anymore. Like, it used to be, a little school like
Cinderella stories.
They would. You're not going to get an Oakland.
Yeah.
You know, making it to the Final Four necessarily, but at the same time, like, this year's tournament's a great example. The Final Four was all one seeds for the men. But the games were incredible.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were a great product to watch as a fan, even if, like, you didn't see Cinderella. Because oftentimes Cinderella is fun and then they get a blowout and it's, you know, the ball's over.
Womp, womp. I got to ask you this because we've been talking about Division I sports and some of the big conferences. I want to know what happens to players from D2 schools or HBCUs or folks who are not at the top schools. Do they get to cash in at all? I mean, I know this, I mean, how does, is there any trickle down effect to those schools?
There is, but not necessarily monetarily. So this settlement really is only on affects Division I. Division II, Division III, NAAI, like, those schools are not party to this. So the revenue sharing is not something that's going to be going on at those levels. And if you are, you know, a very purist fan of college sports and want to watch athletes that are playing for the love of the game, watch those levels because that's what it still is. And the thing that you're going to see, though, is when I was talking about the roster limits, if you there's going to be this slow trickle down, right? Where if you were maybe the fourth string player at Penn State, then maybe you don't have a spot and you go to Temple. So now the fourth string player at Temple then goes
down
to
a level. Yeah.
Villanova, and that Villanova player then goes to somewhere in a D3. And you're going to start to see this like slow movement down.
Yep.
And eventually there's going to be some player at some level that just decides not to play college sports, which is unfortunate. But yeah, it's perhaps that these players are going to be playing at a more appropriate level. So instead of warming the bench for 4 years at a program, they'll be able to contribute more at a program that's more appropriate for what their skill level is.
And my quick follow-up with that is, does it work the opposite way as well, where the bigger schools kind of look down and pluck some of the best players?
Oh, yeah.
You know, from the lower yeah. tier schools.
I mean, you look at college football last year. Cam Ward was a zero-star recruit. He played 2 years at Incarnate Word, then went on to Washington State, then had one season at Miami. So he kind of kept moving up and up and up and getting paid more and more and more. And now he's the number one draft pick.
Yeah.
So a lot of these mid-majors are kind of in a hard spot in terms of continuity and roster building, because they can get these great players that are diamonds in the rough and develop them, but they have no shot of keeping them because these other schools who can offer more money are just mm-hmm. going to do that. And, you know, a player has to decide, you know, do I want to stay here because of my friends, because I like the team, or is this what's going to set me up to go pro? And, you know, you talk to any high school football player and they all think they're going to the NFL. So my guess is
to be young.
Say, okay, give me another level. Yeah.
Yeah. Poor Incarnate Word had the number one future draft pick on their team. Couldn't keep
him. Wow.
But let me bring in this comment Belinda has on YouTube. Belinda teaches at Rutgers and is talking about the fact that the athletic programs run these huge deficits, but that's often like forgivable. And then meanwhile, you know, they're dealing with maybe substandard academic buildings, labs, whatever. And this goes back to an earlier comment we heard from a couple people. Like, I just feel like there is this resentment and there is this friction growing between all the folks on campus who are part of sort of like the traditional academic world in some way or another, whether that's students or teachers, and then the athletes and the athletic departments. And the question I have is, based on how things are going, can these two things reasonably coexist for the next 30, 40, 50 years, given that they just seem to be moving in different directions?
You know, football is harder. That's a harder one to square with that, I think, just because of how much money is going into it.
Right.
The other sports where there's maybe a little bit less, I can sort of see that staying as part of the academy per se. But, you know, I've had a university president tell me that, you know, he was bringing around a prospective professor, I believe. And he's like, we cannot take them to the football training facility because they're going to see that after seeing the academic buildings and they're never going to come here because it's so much nicer.
Wow.
And yeah. And a lot of these universities, because the costs are about to go up because they have to pay these athletes and they're adding scholarships, you know, it's not like these schools have like a $30 million rainy day fund that they can just throw at athletics this year. Like, there's a fire hose that's being turned on of cost that they're going to have to cover. A lot of universities are increasing student fees. They're increasing the cost of going to football games and tickets. So these costs are already being pushed onto the students and, you know, the people that are attending these universities that are not athletes.
Yeah.
So,
and this is
it's
what
hard
I've,
to see.
This is what I've never understood. Mm. And like, you're not going to have a direct answer for this, Lane, but like, all of these schools that keep kind of chasing this big time sports dream, I just, on some level, I just don't get it. Like, you could look at all of these schools, like a University of Chicago or a Ivy League school like Penn, Princeton. These schools essentially opted out of the big time sports arms race decades ago. And as schools, they're doing fine. At some point, aren't some sane people at a place like Rutgers going to question whether or not any of this is actually worth it to build up the brand of the school?
Probably, but you have the devil's advocate of the Flutie effect, right? Where that's what they call it because of the, you know, Boston College incredible, you know, play that happened and everyone was watching on TV, and then applications went way up. Like, that's a really real thing. Like, when Nick Saban came to Alabama and started winning championships, enrollment went up, out of state enrollment went up, their applications went up, the academic standards went up because they were getting better quality students. And like, it all because of them winning championships at sports. Wow. And people wanted to go to games and have fun. And like, that's a very real thing that can happen. And you see that all the time in March Madness with these Cinderellas, where because you're getting all this exposure, applications go up. And so these things can be symbiotic and they can help each other. And that's kind of what these schools are always chasing, because it's the what if, oh, what if we go on this dream run? And what if this is just what turns us around? Like, you're kind of always chasing this high that you have no control over and no guarantee that you're going to get. But if you do, it can be, you know, trajectory changing.
It's a high, high. Yep.
So I want to look into the future, Lane. And 10 years from now, will we look at this moment in time as a breakthrough that finally made college sports fair? Or is this the beginning of the end for the thing that we used to love so much about college sports? How are you feeling? You've been covering this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a turning point. And I don't know that college sports have ever been fair, and that there's always winners and losers. And, you know, you look back at the Big Ten, and I don't think there's ever a world in which, you know, Purdue was going to be beating Michigan every single year at every single sport. Like, there are just, there are differences that are codified into the system that have been there so long. Not that that's good or bad, it just is. And I don't think that this is necessarily going to change that too much. Towards parity. If anything, it might exaggerate that. I think the bigger thing is this is just, it's wresting more control away from the NCAA. And there's been this slow death march of that organization in terms of how it controls college sports. Yep. And I don't know that the thing that comes out of the ashes is going to be better run or better operated, but we're moving closer to getting something else. And that feels like the important step that we're taking now.
Mm. Perhaps a farewell to the NCAA. And I'll say a hurrah for the red and the blue, because that's Penn alum Lane Higgins. Yes. Joining us now, sports reporter at the Wall Street
and
Journal.
D1 athlete. So
former D1 athlete. You were awesome this whole
walk
hour.
On. I would have been the glorified fourth string butterflyer that would have been cut. So let me be clear.
This is something you and I have in common. Lane Higgins for the Wall Street Journal. That was great. You were awesome this whole hour. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you to all the callers. We had some D1 athletes calling in. And thank you to everybody who commented and watched online on YouTube and Facebook. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm still digging around in those crates, folks. You knew I was going to say it. I'm Avi Wolf and Aaron. Hey, we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.